It's always a privilege to say, after 45 years, and right now, this is WTIC Radio in Hartford, Connecticut.
I'm Dick Bertel, your host for the next hour, as WTIC Radio celebrates its 45th anniversary. Before we journey back through the years, I'd like to introduce Mr. Leonard J. Patricelli, president of Broadcast Plaza Incorporated. Mr. Patricelli.
Thank you, Dick. Tonight, we at WTIC Radio are indulging in a rare luxury. We're looking back. We're looking back on a lot of history. 45 years of entertaining and informing the people of Southern New England. And I hope you'll excuse us if we look back with just a little pride at what we've done. After tonight's review of our 45 years on the air, I promise a prompt return to our primary mission, providing you with information as new as tomorrow's news and entertainment as modern and lively as the 70s. But in the meantime, I hope you will enjoy our look at where we've been in the past 45 years. We certainly will enjoy bringing it to you, for by occasionally looking back, we can develop a better idea of where we should be going in the years to come.
WTIC was an idea in the summer of 1924, when the late Walter G. Coles, vice president of the Travelers Insurance Company, convinced Lewis F. Butler, then president of the Travelers, that the company should embark into the field of radio broadcasting. Hartford was without a broadcasting station in 1924, the year that the Travelers applied for a license to operate such a facility. In the fall of 24, the Department of Commerce granted a license for WTIC to operate a 500-watt transmitter on the 860 kilocycle frequency. Two steel towers were erected atop the Travelers' Grove Street building. After two major test broadcasts in December 1924, regular broadcasting began on February 10, 1925. From the very beginning, it was obvious that the company was not thinking of using the station for commercials of its own, let alone those of outside business houses. Not long after the initiation of regular service, WTIC Radio was on its way to national prominence with an increasing number of programs originating in the Hartford studios and carried coast to coast via makeshift networks of stations. From its very inception, broadcasting has relied on music for much of its daily fare. Soon to become a national favorite, the music of Norman Clothier and the Merry Madcaps was heard on WTIC from almost the very beginning.
takes you back, doesn't it? The music of Norman Clothier and his orchestra was to be heard throughout the nation, originating from the Hartford studios of WTIC.
We were a network feature. I was a vocalist with them at the time. I think we were on for about 9 years altogether.
One of the singers heard with the Clothier band, Fred Wade.
And they didn't realize just how popular they were throughout the country. Of course, it was a network show. And we used to have people come in here from the South or the Midwest, or the orchestra is very popular in Canada. And they'd come in, you know, and the first thing they wanted to see, the Merry Madcaps and Norm Clothier. And we couldn't figure it out, you know, why we were so popular around here. Of course, you know, no man is a prophet in his own country, so right. They say. And some of the comments would be, we want to see that. You know, in our hometown, when you folks go on the air, he says, everything stops. He says, no one works, no one does anything. They just listen to the Merry Madcaps. But that was the opinion of many people throughout the country.
Milestones were passed rapidly. In March of 1925, WTIC joined in the first coast-to-coast broadcast of a presidential inauguration. The man inaugurated was Calvin Coolidge.
I believe in the American Constitution. I favor the American system of individual enterprise, and I am opposed to any general extension of government ownership and control. I believe not only in advocating economy and public expenditure, but in its practical application and actual accomplishment.
Information and news of world events were in the air. They were joined by the radio drama and the discussion show, plus the live bands and choral groups. A series of health talks began in 1925 and was heard for more than two decades. And live sports broadcasts were heard in southern New England when in the fall of 1925, WTIC joined a network in the play-by-play coverage of the Cornell Penn football tilt. The sportscasters, Phillips Carlin and Graham McNamee. Broadcasts involving Connecticut's Institutes of Higher Learning gathered momentum with the installation of lines between the TIC studios in Hartford and the Yale campus in New Haven. Yet throughout this entire period, no advertising was permitted on the air. A unique situation existed. A firm was allowed to present programs under their corporate title, but without commercial announcements. There was no charge to the sponsor for the time. He merely was responsible for talent and production costs. The NBC chimes as they sounded in the early 30s. WTIC was one of the first half dozen of the country's radio stations to affiliate with the National Broadcasting Company network. Listeners to WTIC on the evening of February 15, 1926, were introduced to NBC through a formal opening broadcast. Featured on that memorable evening were the New York Symphony Orchestra, the Goldman Band, B.A. Rolfe and his orchestra, Tito Ruffo, Harold Bauer, Mary Garden, Will Rogers, and Weber and Fields.
Hello, Janie.
Did you get things settled, Lyshy?
Get what things settled?
Oh, I was hoping you'd discovered some way to help Harry.
No, I tried, but there ain't a plagued thing I can think of but coming right flat out and offering him some money, and I know doggone well he'll refuse it.
Ah, yes, the folks from Wrightville, Eunice Greenwood, Paul Lucas, and Fred Wade. Starting in the mid-30s, the Wrightville Clarion was regular listening on TIC.
Oh, dear, if he only hadn't gone to that Perkins.
Hi, folks. Dinner ready?
Not yet. Where have you been?
Oh, been out. Stopped in at the Clarion, Lyshy, but you'd gone. I was going to walk home with you.
Hey, what you got to be so glum about on this nice day?
Sometimes I think you got a heart like a stone.
Who, me?
Yes, you.
Oh, let him alone, Jenny.
How he can react the way he does to all that trouble Harry Stebbins is into, I don't know.
Oh, Harry Stebbins again, eh? Thought that was all discussed last night.
It's all right, Zeke. Just forget it.
Leastways, I gave my opinions last evening. If I recollect right, I said there's always work for a fella if he tries to find it.
I'll get dinner on the table.
Seems like she's kind of gone off the deep end on this thing, don't it?
You can't hardly blame her for feeling sorry for them folks.
Always work for fellas, though, if he wants to find it.
You can find any work for Harry Stebbins, I'll buy you the best nickel cigar on the market.
Your generosity is your worst enemy, Lyshy. But be that as it might.
Yeah.
Be that as it might. Has your worrying over that fella and his wife and the young ones accomplished anything?
Not so far.
So it ain't done much good to worry, has it?
That ain't the point.
Oh, yes, it is. No, sir, old neighbor, old friend. Worrying ain't done no good. So I'd advise you to stop it.
gives the body indigestion. Keeps the food from being absorbed in the system. Gives you spots in front of the eyes. Don't worry about Harry Stebbins. He'll come out all right.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. He's a real wide-awake young fella. Don't worry about him.
What do you mean, he's a wide-awake young fella?
Just what I said. He knows farming from A to Z, just like Janie was saying last night.
How do you know?
I was talking to him.
When?
This morning.
This morning?
What's wrong with that?
Well, now,
dinner's on the table. Oh, land knows I ain't going to be able to eat a mouthful.
Yeah, well, just a minute, Jenny.
Yeah, just a minute. As I said, Lassie, that fellow's got a smart mind. He'll go places. You just wait and see.
Who are you talking about?
Zeke seen Harry Stebbins this morning.
What for? To remind him that there's always work for idle hands to do?
The quotation is, there's always work for eager hands to do, Jenny, not idle hands.
Well, whatever it is.
No, I didn't go over to preach to him. I went over to hire him.
To hire him?
What's that?
Yeah, to hire him.
What on earth for?
Well, when I bought that farm back from old man Perkins, I naturally had to cast around for somebody to run it.
What?
You bought Harry's farm from old man Perkins?
Just so. Well, I couldn't run it myself, could I?
Well, you...
So, who should I pick to run it but the fellow that was used to running it?
I could kiss you.
Well, I'll be doggone. Why didn't we think of that?
Because you two was occupied thinking up new ways to feel sorry for him. Feeling sorry for a body never done no good. Action is what gets results.
Oh, Zeke, it was so marvelous of you.
Oh, be still with you. Come on, eat now. Yeah, and I still maintain there's always work for eager hands to do. Yes, sir. Yeah, even if I had to buy a farm to prove it.
September of 1936 marked another milestone in WTIC history. In that month, the station joined the Yankee Network, an affiliation that was to last about 6 years. One of 36's most popular programs was Hull's Hour of Cheer, produced by Leonard Patricelli.
Presenting Hull's Hour of Cheer and offering for your entertainment, the Four Royal Waiters.
With a sign on the table and a good song ringing clear.
Your favorite voice in your favorite song, Fred Wade.
Romance, romance may come with a spring or a fall.
And the dancing rhythms of Rudy Martin and his orchestra.
The Hour of Cheer brought the big band sound into southern New England homes with all the newest hits.
Cheer continues with the latest song hit from the pen of Carmen Lombardo, Dreamy Eyes.
Yet another program that Fred Wade and George Beau took part in was Stories in Song. Well-known stories from literature were adapted for radio and told by the old colonel, portrayed by the late Bernard Mullins. Songs complementing the story were sung by Fred Wade with Hal Kolb at the organ.
Stories in song. And now for the old colonel and tonight's story in song.
Only 26 years old, and already Gilbert Howard was recognized as one of the ablest newspaper critics in the country. One mention in Howard's column, that is, a praiseworthy mention, and thousands would flock to see or hear the fortunate performer. And one day, the seemingly impossible came to pass. A ballet dancer received not one, but three laudatory mentions. Her name, Rosalie Patterson, American, the prima ballerina of the Royal Ballet, whose guiding spirit was the great Russian master, Igor Bodovsky. Yes, Rosalie Patterson was a splendid artist, certainly deserving of praise. But what the people who read Howard's column did not know was that Gilbert Howard had fallen deeply in love with the beautiful and talented young dancer. It was, of course, a very simple matter to arrange for interviews. And one evening, supposedly in the process of gathering material for his column, Mr. Howard dropped his famous little red book and pencil to take Rosalie's hand in his own. And that young lady, surprised, asked, "Why, Mr. Howard, isn't this rather unusual procedure for a newspaper interview?" And our Mr. Howard, still holding her hand in his, said, "Oh, please forget that I'm Howard, the critic, the newspaper man. I've something very important to tell you. Important because..."
"Rosalie, my darling, Rosalie, my dream, since one night when stars danced above, I moaned so much in love. My life thrilling, and tell me you're willing to be mine, Rosalie, mine."
In the 30s, the noon hour was brightened considerably by the presence of noontime varieties.
And now it's my pleasure to turn this program over to that romantic Romeo, that beloved personality of the airways, that one
Thank
and only...
Thank you very much, my friend. I didn't expect to introduce like that.
Quiet, Batiste. As I was saying, ladies and gentlemen, I give you now your singing host, Fred Wade.
Oh, Fred Wade. That's a nice thank for giving anybody there.
Out of my way, Shorty, before I step on you. All right, Al.
Out of the darkness, you suddenly appear. You smiled and I was taken by surprise. I guess I should have seen right through you, but the moon got in my eyes. I was so thrilled by the love you volunteered. I gave my heart without a compromise. I guess you don't remember, do you, when the moon got in my eyes? I thought a kingdom was in sight, that I would have the right to claim. But with the morning's early light, I didn't have a dream to my name. You know the saying that all who love are blind. It seems that ancient adage still applies. I guess I should have seen
Well, Mr. Weeds, whatever about I say, me, I say too.
Well,
I think you the good singer.
Say, by the way, what are you doing here anyways, Batiste?
I was told you that a few minutes ago there. I want for Hags the flavor on you for give me some job on your program.
Oh, you mean you want to help tell people the value of drinking more milk, I suppose.
Yeah, that's
well,
it.
Have you had any experience?
Well, of course. Didn't you know I was once take the examination, what they call the civilized service for be the milkman?
Oh, I suppose you mean civil service.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah.
Well, how many questions did they ask you?
Well, only one. They asked me, how far is it to the moon?
Yeah.
I see. I don't know how far is it to the moon. But if that's the milk route you're going to give me, then you can keep the job. That's what I thought.
Say, by the way, how's your father doing, Batiste? Is he still working in the meat market?
Oh, no, he's got fired.
So, well, what happened?
Well, you know, the boss told him to close up the store, you know, the other night there.
Yeah, yeah.
And for put all the meat on the high spot and hang it up on those hook in there.
Sure.
So the next morning when the boss come in, my father, he was still on the high spot. So the boss say, what's the matter? You've been here all night? I told you for hang those meat up on the hook, and that only take 5 minutes for do that.
Yeah.
Sure, my father say, it only take 5 minutes till I come to the hamburgs. You try and hang some hamburg on the hook, mister, and you're going to be here all night too. That's what he say.
Well, I'm afraid yours is not a working family, Batiste, and I'm practically sure you won't be working on this program.
Oh, I'm sorry for it you say that, Mr. Weiss. Maybe you don't say that if you give me some another chance, eh?
Oh, I see. You still want to turn this program into what you might call a question buzz, eh?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Well, all right. One more chance, and I'll make it an easy one. Batiste, who is the father of this country?
Father of this country?
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe it's Hetty Cantor's Bing Crosby's.
No. Wrong again. You see? Well, I'll bet you don't even know who's the father of your own country.
The fathers of Canada?
Yeah.
Oh, everybody should know that. The father of Canada, that's Monsieur Dion.
One of the major broadcasting endeavors by the young WTIC was the Guy Hedlund Playhouse. From a recording made in the late 30s, here is a portion of one of 1,000 radio dramas presented by Guy Hedlund and his group.
Guy Hedlund and Company. Good afternoon, matinee friends. This is St. Patrick's Day, and in honor of the occasion, we bring you a story written especially for this program. The title is The Man Who Could Fly, and it's from the pen of John Pullen, a rising young Hartford author. Our play takes place on a modest country estate at Wicklow, Ireland. In the hallway of the large old house, our scene begins.
Dan, where are you, old Dan Kinneen?
Whist, quiet, girl. I'm here in the study.
Oh, I've come over to see the sick lad you brought home from India.
Well, sure, now that sleel neighbor believe you, lass. But I think you'd better wait a while. There's a great doctor in there examining my nephew now.
Oh, is he worse?
No, indeed, he's better.
Then why the doctor?
Well, it's a special doctor, a great psychiatrist.
Oh.
The one we had before was just a common weekday kind of a doctor, you understand. And Tommy puzzled him entirely with his queer raving and ranting when he was sick. So he said we'd better have Dr. Morley over from London.
You mean something has turned his brain?
Well, I don't know, Kathleen. I'm waiting now to hear.
Oh, and he's such a fine, handsome young man.
Yes, it'll be a poor thing indeed if he's lost his wits. I'm half distracted about it all.
Well, then perhaps I'd better be calling another day.
Oh, no, don't hurry away, lass. Go out in the garden and see my verbenas. I still have them in the hotbed.
What? They're still under glass?
Yes, for I'm afraid that when night is down, the cold mist will choke the poor things.
Oh, I love your fine big garden, Dan. Sure, that's what I'll do now. I'll visit the verbenas and come back later.
Yes, come back later, Kathleen. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. How much longer will they be in there? Oh, doctor, how is Tommy?
He's resting.
Do you mean he's asleep?
No, not exactly. I've had him under partial hypnosis.
Oh, the poor boy.
He'll wake up directly.
Oh, tell me, doctor, what ails him?
Why, not a thing, physically.
Doctor, you don't mean the boy has gone crazy?
Your nephew seems quite normal, save in one respect. It's a strange case. A strange case.
Oh, what is it, doctor? What's the matter?
Well, while under psychosis, he revealed an important thing. The young man believes he can fly.
Believes he can fly? I don't wish it, doctor. I'm sure he's lost his wits altogether.
Well, it's not an unusual psychosis.
Oh, has he got that too?
I've had cases that had to be restrained from jumping off high buildings on that account.
Oh, it'd be unfortunate indeed if the poor young lad jumped off a cliff and shattered out his brains. He's been through so much trouble already.
Mr. Kinney, tell me more about Tommy's background.
Well, there's little enough I know to tell, doctor. When my brother and his wife were killed in India, I went over and put Tommy in a by school in Calcutta under the care of my friend, Lieutenant Hargraves. And in a few years, sure didn't the boy leave the school and disappear entirely.
How long ago was that?
Let me see, that was 16... Oh, I have no memory anymore at all. 18 years ago that was. And it was only last month that Lieutenant Hargraves found him in Sydney, Australia, sick in a hospital with a fever.
And what had Tommy done in the meantime? Where had he been?
He'd wandered to all the ends of the earth, all alone, the poor boy.
Mm-hmm. And what were the boy's parents like?
Well, now, I never knew his mother. No? She was from the county Westmeath. I never had much use for those mixed marriages. But I do recall that his father had queer notions sometimes. Why, when we were boys together and went to the mountains, he believed the little wild folk were there.
Really?
He used to tell me they put bannocks on the road for travelers to eat. And if you didn't eat them, they'd bait you. And all such queer tales as that. but he got over it, all right.
Well, let's hope that now that Tommy has been restored to a normal life, that he'll get over his queer notion, too.
Doc, I know just what I'll do for Tommy.
What?
Tonight I'll have a great party for him.
Splendid.
I'll have Kathleen, that pretty golden-haired girl from next door, in.
Ah, yes.
And her friends. And sure we'll have music and dancing.
Just the things.
And Porter.
Ah, yes.
Just heard the original radio play, The Man Who Could Fly, written by John Pullen. In the play, the part of Kathleen was taken by Gertrude Warner, and that of Tommy, The Man Who Could Fly, by Guy Hedlund. The part of Uncle Dan was portrayed by Edward Begley, and that of Dr. Morley by Eric Dane. The next play, on Monday night at 10:30 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Until then, Guy Hedlund, his players, and your announcer, Paul Lucas, will say good afternoon and a happy St. Patrick's Day.
This is WTIC, Hartford.
I like to learn that dance where I throw Lena all over the place, you know, and throw around my head and whirl around my neck and all that stuff.
Well, you're not getting into any dancing like that. You want to whirl someone around your neck, get Louie or a dummy or somebody.
Remember Jake and Lena? Well, if Jake and Lena were friends of yours, Gene and Glenn were acquaintances, too. On August 3rd, 1940, this twosome, or could it be a foursome, began a happy relationship with Southern New England residents.
With a howdy we greet you, oh the morning is grand. We'd love to meet you and shake your hand. Oh, there's nothing like music when the morning is gray. It brings us sunshine all through the day. If trouble's troubling you, kind friend, we'll do our best and try to send a smile or two just to end your worries for a while. So do you say howdy, oh, the morning is grand, the best old morning in the best old land.
Well, Jake and Lena are comparatively peaceful today. No lions are on the loose to worry about. And the pet shop is functioning once more. There seems to be just one thing on Lena's mind today, and she's asking Glenn what he thinks about it right now, so let's drop in on them and hear what's being said.
I found this here animal list, and Jake has checked off a lot of wild animals, but you can see for yourself here. Here it is right here.
Oh, I see. Oh, he isn't planning on ordering these, I'm sure.
Well, you never know what Jake is going to do. I wish you'd ask him about it.
I will. She has a... A python marked here, and also a black leopard.
And an elephant over here he's got checked off. Now, what could I do with an elephant in a pet shop?
Oh, that's out of the question.
Oh, certainly.
20-foot python.
Yes, imagine. What is a python?
A snake.
A snake?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness me. In my pet shop, a snake.
How's business at the pet shop?
I sold my first canary yesterday since the trouble started. I sold a chopper.
Chopper? What's that, sort of a woodpecker?
Oh, it's pretty good, Glenn. No, it's a canary.
Oh, is it a canary?
American chopper, they call it, and they sing their heads off.
They do, huh?
Yeah, you see, they ain't importing them Hartz Mountain Rollers now on account of the war, you know. I can't get them.
I understand, like a lot of items.
Mm-hmm. So, I tell how Mr. Weber come up after Ginger, did I tell you?
What was that?
Did I tell you how Mr. Weber come after Ginger?
Oh, is Mr. Weber back in town?
Oh, yes. He had a fit laughing when he heard how Ginger got loose and scared everybody to death nearly.
Personally, I don't think it was any laughing matter.
I know it. But anyway, he came over to see the lion, and the poor thing was so happy to see him.
What do you mean, happy?
Well, he rubbed his head against the bar so Mr. Weber could scratch his head.
The lion did?
Mm-hmm. So finally, Mr. Weber went right into the cage, and Ginger just laid down and rolled over like a great big cat.
He did.
And Mr. Weber just patted him and rubbed him.
Can you beat that? Yeah. He wasn't a bit savage, huh?
No, not a bit. Mr. Weber says if you have the confidence of a wild animal and they like you, you can do anything with them.
New programs came in strength in 1940, and another show that was to enjoy a long run and delight listeners started with Bruce Kern calling...
Is Springfield ready?
Yeah!
Is Hartford ready?
Yeah!
And make way for the Quiz of Two Cities, presented by Listerine Toothpaste. Another fast and furious quiz session between Springfield and Hartford. The last week, Springfield added another solid win to their season's total, and right now our big scoreboard reads 56 wins for Springfield, 51 wins for Hartford, with 7 ties. And ready to introduce his Springfield team is that never-lost-for-words fella, Turner Cook.
And thanks, folks, and greetings from the broadcast lounge of the Hotel Sheraton Springfield. And Bruce Kern, I've got a never-lost-for-the-right-answer team tonight, representing the Boy Scouts organization here in Springfield. Wait till you hear them.
Okay, Cookie. Now, George Bowen in Hartford, what have you got to say?
Hiya, quiz fans!
Wow.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was a Class A applause from the Boy Scouts in our audience here tonight. And they give that only for Class A things. They didn't mean that for me. That was for our team tonight, I know. And greetings to you, Bruce, too. Might just as well say hello to Cookie now, because after my team from the Charter Oak Council Boy Scouts of America gets finished, oh, I'm sure he won't even talk to me. He'll be so mad.
During World War II, WTIC put its entire might behind the war effort. Special programs originating in the WTIC studios were fed to NBC for broadcast throughout the United States. And they were also broadcast worldwide by international shortwave. One of the most popular and inspiring programs was the United States Coast Guard on Parade, produced by George Bowe, originating from the Coast Guard Academy in New London, and emceed by Bob Tyrrell.
We're always ready for the call. We place our trust in thee. Through surf and storm and howling gale, high shall our purpose be. Semper Paratus is our guide, our fame, our glory too. To fight, to save, or fight and die, I, Coast Guard, we're all for you. At this same time, we shall bring you another half hour of music by the Coast Guard Academy Band, conducted by Charles W. Messer, playing from the Coast Guard Academy at New London, Connecticut. And more stories of the Coast Guard in training and in action on our far-flung battlefronts. This program is sent by International Shortwave to our men in the armed forces. This is Seaman Second Class Bob Tyrrell speaking. On behalf of Rear Admiral James Pine, Superintendent of the Coast Guard Academy, we invite you to join us 1 week from today in our victorious march forward with the United States Coast Guard on parade.
In July 1944, the Allied forces were pushing across Europe, and the home folks were in a mood to relax a bit. Hundreds of Central Connecticut men, women, and children were breathlessly enjoying the excitement of Ringling Brothers' Barnum and Bailey Circus under the big tent in Hartford on July 6th, when suddenly the faces of smiling, excited circus fans turned to masks of panic. Bernard Mullins and George Bowe were at the scene of the Holocaust.
Hello, everyone. Well, Hartford this afternoon suffered one of the greatest catastrophes in its history, when during a matinee performance of Ringling Brothers' Barnum and Bailey Circus, the big tent suddenly burst into flame and burned to the ground, causing more than 100 deaths and unestimated casualties. WTIC's George Bowe and myself were on the grounds within a few minutes after the conflagration had leveled the big show, and while smoke was still rising from the horrible mass of canvas and poles and bleachers.
That's right, Bernard. According to eyewitnesses at the scene, the fire started at about 2:33 after the show had been underway a quarter of an hour, and we were on the grounds about 3 o'clock. Bernard, what was that story that the woman survivor told you there?
Well, she was a lady from Meriden, George, attending the show with her 6-year-old son. Fortunately, they were seated near an exit at the far end of the tent and managed to escape. Her little boy was seated directly in front of her in the 6th row. The first indication of anything wrong came when the cry of fire was heard, and immediately a wisp of smoke came from the side wall near the front entrance. This lady pushed her youngster off the seat, and as he landed on the ground, she told him not to rush, but to keep going toward that exit. They were among the first dozen or so out.
Yes, and that wisp of smoke developed in a matter of seconds into a blazing inferno. In fact, in 2.5 minutes, the entire tent was enveloped in flames and had collapsed. An eyewitness in an office across the street told us that it appeared almost like spontaneous combustion, so quickly was the big tent a mass of flames.
Quoting from Francis Chase's book, Sound and Fury.
Needless to say, regular programs were canceled as the entire staff devoted itself to the task of spiking wild rumors, passing on accurate information, and reassuring families throughout the community. Service in the public interest was the uppermost thought in WTIC's swiftly planned coverage of the disaster. The incident proved that radio has humane objectives that can be achieved in times of great trial, largely because of the huge listener confidence placed in the medium by an audience that has learned to accept the honesty and reliability of broadcasting's public service role.
Bob Tyrrell teamed up with Floyd Richards after the war to co-host one of Connecticut's all-time favorite audience participation shows, Cinderella Weekend. The program was on for almost 5 years. Here's a segment of one of the last shows.
Is there a Cinderella in the house. Yeah! Well, let's dream of a Cinderella weekend. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Floyd Richard.
And Bob Giro.
And here we are with a couple of studios full of Cinderella fans all down here in the closing days of our current stay with Cinderella. And we should have a great time today. We have four lovely ladies on stage. We have prizes and fun for everyone. Bob, do you have anything to add in these opening moments?
These opening and closing moments,
yeah.
Well, I think it's most gratifying to see so many ladies, a lot of them we've never seen before here in our studio. They came down to take a kind of last peek at Cinderella, I guess. I do want a little reminder in here that you folks out in Willimantic, in and around, are going to have an opportunity to see Cinderella Weekend in its stage form, because we're bringing the whole gang, Hal and Miss Setup, Floyd Richards, and yours truly, at Schaefer Auditorium in Willimantic, Connecticut, for the Mansfield Center PTO. They have a lot of wonderful prizes. I understand, Floyd, that Cinderella's prize is valued at around $50.
Good. Well, let's look for our Cinderella of the day here from these four ladies. Mrs. Marion Miller from Collinsville, Connecticut, Mrs. Helen Koseko from Milford, Mrs. Elizabeth Tracy from Newington, and Mrs. Dorothy Cole from East Hartford. One will become our Thursday Cinderella.
Songs from New England colleges.
Men of Dartmouth, give a round for the college on the hill, for the long line of a bird and the loyal sons who love her. Give a round with a will.
Men of Dartmouth. The Dartmouth Glee Club sings the Dartmouth alma mater to begin another in the current series of concerts brought to you each Sunday at this time by Monsanto of Boston, part of the worldwide Monsanto Chemical Company.
They have the still north in their hearts, the hill winds in their veins, and the granite of New Hampshire in their muscles and their brains, and the granite.
Webster Hall on the Dartmouth campus in Hanover, New Hampshire, Paul R. Zeller directs the Dartmouth Glee Club in a program which includes several college songs popular here in New England. Now one of the finest and best-known songs on the Dartmouth campus. Leslie Richard of Portland, Maine is the baritone soloist as we hear the famous Hanover Winter Song.
Oh, a song by the fire, past the pipes, past the bowl. Oh, a song by the fire, with a skull, with a skull.
Leonard Patricelli wrote and produced songs from New England colleges. Mr. Patricelli, I'm sure you recall this series fondly.
Yes, that was a series that ran 4 years and involved three men, really, from this station. Bob Tyrrell as the announcer, Al Jackson as the engineer, and myself as the writer and producer. Mm-hmm. And we traveled an average of 23 colleges each winter. We'd start around the last week in October, and we go right through to March or so, or April. And we would actually produce the programs from the college campus, wherever it might be, Dartmouth, the University of Maine, Yale, etc. And it entailed our leaving in snowstorms, coming back in ice storms, and we had many a narrow escape on the road, it's one of the, I think, one of the finest program series we ever had on WTIC radio.
Sleigh bells jingle as they pass. Zoom!
1951 found American GIs in Korea. In southern New England, the 43rd Division was called up to active duty.
It's all aboard with the 43rd. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ed Anderson speaking to you from the Morgan Street siding in Hartford. We're down here this evening. The Special Events Department of WTIC has set up its equipment to bring you by transcription a description of the departure of Connecticut elements of the 43rd Division. And you can hear in the background the music of the lead band as the 1040 section of the Connecticut 43rd takes off. One element has already taken off at 10:20. Now, this group coming into the Morgan Street siding will leave at approximately 10:40. You can hear the siren of the police car as it leads the section down into the yard here. There's a crowd now. There are many hundreds of people down here, and I can just see over their heads the two flags, the state flag and the American flag, coming down the line, and they are being carried by a detachment of the Hartford Police Force. Now, we're going to try to pick up the identity of that band whose music we can hear. There they go. We've just stepped down close to one of these cars here, and they've turned off, and we can just see a couple of bass horns, and that is all. I was told that that is the governor's foot guard. We also know that there probably is another band in the lineup consisting of members of the Hartford Local 400 of the Musicians Union. Now, that might be the group. You can hear them playing, "Hail, hail, the game's all, the gang is all here." And here come the advanced men of the 43rd Division marching to their places along the siding here. Three officers here. I couldn't quite pick up that gentleman's rank. That may be Colonel Wozinski leading his troops into the yard. Now there are a lot of wives and fathers and brothers, a lot of girlfriends hanging on to the arms of these GIs as they come in. We will have to report somewhat grim-faced into the siding here to take their positions in these Pullman or in these coaches, which will take them down to Camp Pickett, Virginia.
On the world and national news scene in 1956. Listeners heard of the solution to the great Brinks robbery. Eight men were sentenced to life terms for the nearly $3 million heist in 1950. Russian communists disavowed the Stalin line. Movie star Grace Kelly married Prince Rainier of Monaco. And the United States made its first airdrop of an H-bomb over a remote Pacific island. President Eisenhower underwent surgery, and Egypt seized the Suez Canal. The Hungarian revolt brought the free world to its feet, and Dwight Eisenhower, recovered from surgery, was re-elected to the presidency of the United States. In Hartford, the year's leading story was the tragic destruction of St. Joseph's Cathedral by fire. WTIC listeners heard Ed Anderson describe the devastating fire.
We cannot make any predictions here, but we can make comparisons. Compared to when we first arrived on the scene, the smoke has increased in intensity. There is deep red flame inside the building. It is rolling, the smoke that is, slowly up over the dome of the rear of the cathedral into this December sky, which is registering a temperature of 16 degrees at this time during the day. A light snow flurry is falling and thus hampering to some extent the firemen, although they have earlier stated that they didn't have the hardship that they did Saturday night when battling the St. Patrick's fire. Now, kind of holes that I can see going up one of the area ladders on which are perched four firemen. It is now raging out of control. The Hartford firemen seem to have lost this battle to save the 64-year-old cathedral. Flames are pouring out both sides up the top. The dome, which is now encased in thick, heavy, towering smoke, rising cumbersomely into the air, is lined also with the red of the eager, hungry flames which lick up through it.
In Hartford, years of preparation were rewarded when the FCC gave WTIC permission to telecast on Channel 3 in September of 1957. For WTIC, the advent of Channel 3 meant tremendous expansion in staff and a need for expanded physical facilities. On April 14, 1960, ground was broken for WTIC's new home, Broadcast House, in the city's first downtown urban renewal project. The chairman of Constitution Plaza, Incorporated, Gladden W. Baker, addressed the gathering.
This street here to the east is called Front Street. Years ago, when life was more simple here, Front Street was an important location coming down from the old State House down to the river, a gentle grade, and a more quiet quiet time. It was sort of the front door at that time. After that, it came on less favorable days, and we had a lot of slums here. But now, when this project is finished, the Constitution Plaza, this will again be the front door of Hartford. Thank you all.
Hartford's Constitution Plaza was taking shape. Out of the mid-city pits were growing the magnificent structures which would soon be a model to the entire country of what one city could do to revitalize its central core. The first building occupied was Broadcast House. At the dedication of WTIC's new home on the evening of November 27, 1961, Paul W. Morency addressed the studio and listening audience.
May I say that it is a good feeling to be with friends this evening. A most important evening in the history of WTIC and its offspring, WTIC FM and TV. This is a time of renewal, a time of thanksgiving, and a time of rededication. Broadcast House, this new four-story home for our three stations, is the first unit to be completed and occupied in Constitution Plaza. An urban renewal which boldly foretells a bright future for Hartford. The challenging opportunity to serve the vigorous, enterprising mind and spirit of the people of Connecticut and southern New England has been ours for over 37 years. We wish to thank you, the people, who have listened to our radio voice for those 37 years and for the past 4 years have welcomed Channel 3 into your homes. We wish to thank our friends and associates who work with us in this broadcast house. This industry, like many others, is one that calls for exhaustive effort and complete dedication. Here at Broadcast House, we have 164 dedicated people on our staff. Some have been with us for several years. Others have been with WTIC since it started in 1925. I can't begin to tell you how hard these men and women have worked to make our stations and this moment possible.
This is Dick Bertel at the scene of a multi-alarm fire at the Hartford Hospital. In front of me, as I face the front of Hartford Hospital, is a maze of fire trucks, fire hose, and firefighting equipment of all description. This is a fire confined to the 9th, 10th, and 11th floor. There are approximately...
Yes, fire struck at a community hospital again in December 1961, just 16 years after the tragic Nile Street Hospital fire. In mid-afternoon on the 8th, fire and emergency vehicles raced to Hartford Hospital. I was part of the WTIC special events crew that arrived with the fire trucks and saw the billowing smoke pouring from ninth floor windows. TIC newsman Dick O'Brien saw it this way.
I'm speaking from the ninth floor. I've worked my way up now to the disaster spot itself, and we have a figure of 9 persons dead here on the ninth floor of Hartford Hospital. That figure comes from State Police Commissioner Leo Mulcahy, who I talked with just moments ago. He believes there are 3 more dead on another floor. We do not know exactly which one. We believe it probably is down on the 8th, but we are uncertain. Known dead here on the 9th floor, 9 persons in this fire. They are now mopping up. Dick O'Brien on the 9th floor at Hartford Hospital.
Another American astronaut captured the lead position in early 1963 news stories. Gordon Cooper was the first American to spend an extended period in space. Late in November, the phone lines to WTIC's Mike Line program were crowded as usual.
When is the best time to trim young maple trees?
Right.
All right, we'll ask, and if anyone knows, we'll invite them to call us today.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
And thank you. Yes, bye-bye. Bye. When is the best time to trim young maple trees?
Floyd, I have something rather important from the WTIC newsroom in the form of a bulletin. President Kennedy is reported to have been wounded by an assassin in Dallas, Texas. There are no further details available at this time. We repeat, President Kennedy has been wounded by an assassin in Dallas, Texas. We will have further details as received. I'm sure everybody joins us in deploring this regretful news.
I should think
so. We'll bring details as soon as we possibly can.
We certainly will. We'll stay right on top of that. All right, let's see if we can continue on with Mike Line here while awaiting any more news from our newsroom. Hello?
Oh, golly. Isn't that awful?
It certainly is.
I got the recipe. This is Roz Fishman.
Yes, Roz. Okay.
Oh, my. I just took my breath away.
Did ours, too.
I think so.
Floyd Richards and Bob Ellsworth tried to carry on with Mike Line. Then another bulletin.
Will you hold it just a minute, Roz?
Sure.
We have some.
Here are further details from the WTIC newsroom. President Kennedy and Governor John B. Connally of Texas were cut down by an assassin's bullets. As they toured downtown Dallas in an open automobile today, the president, his limp body cradled in the arms of his wife, was rushed to Parkland Hospital. We will give you further details as received. Well, this rather changes the complexion of many, many things at this time, and it looks as if we have two national victims here, the governor and the president, at this first reading. This is a very regretful thing, and the kind of news which I'm afraid is a little bit more than I care to handle, but we've got to be on the job anyway. We'll continue along, Floyd.
Well, Roz, you're right in the middle of a terrible thing here. Perhaps we'd be best to just keep right on going as best we can.
What was there to say? What was there to do? At WTIC, work began immediately, preparing special programs of music. Through NBC and our own WTIC newsroom, listeners were able to witness every event of those tragic days. From the jazz age to the space age, from Lindbergh's flight to Paris to voices of men on the moon, you have been there with WTIC Radio. The microphone and the speaker know no bounds. They go with man as he molds his destiny and broadcast the events of our times. At WTIC Radio, we've entertained and informed for 45 years. Our microphones were there in 1965 when the Connecticut Constitutional Convention was convened in the historic old State House. You heard reports and discussions of the pros and cons of school busing, and you followed the progress of the project. Through radio, you were almost ear witnesses to the tragic assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. And you probably participated in the Martin Luther King Youth Fund, which was established by WTIC and other news media to aid young people in the black community. WTIC has helped you become more aware of the problems of the core city. You have felt their frustrations as alcoholics discussed their problems. You have learned more of drug abuse problems from police, parents, pushers, addicts, and professional experts. You have found yourself in the midst of crowds bent on destruction, and you have been in the company of individuals dedicated to preserve our environment. You have listened to the words of your neighbors and leaders in the community and the state, and in many cases, you have added your voice to the discussion at hand. For 45 years, WTIC Radio has been privileged to serve Connecticut and Southern New England. Our reward for this record is the ability to continue as a major source of information and entertainment. We look forward to being with you for years to come.
This 45th anniversary program was written and produced by Dave Wilkinson, assisted by Chuck Raynaud. Your host was Dick Bertel. WTIC, AM and FM, Hartford.
Good evening, this is Norm Peters with WTIC News at 11 o'clock.